You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. And now, here's today's message.
Open with a word of prayer. Father, I come before you tonight. I thank you for your word and the treasures it contains. Help us to mind those tonight and to learn how to apply your word to our lives. In Christ's name I pray. Amen. So the overall dynamic of the book of Exodus, as we start each week talking about, is the movement from the forced series, a service of building storehouses for Pharaoh, to the willing service of building a tabernacle for God at the foot of Mount Sinai. The problem with Egyptian slavery wasn't that Israel was forced to work. We were created for work. The problem was rather that Israel was working on the wrong project and for the wrong master. And so Exodus is divided into two panels with five sections each. And in the first panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered from service to Pharaoh. And in the second panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered for service to the Lord. So the central theme of Exodus is this tale of two building projects, a tale that contrasts the rebellious human desire to build Babel with the covenantal promise to restore the garden sanctuary. And so the first panel of Exodus is from chapter 1 to the end of chapter 13, as the Lord delivers Israel from service to Pharaoh. And the second panel is the Lord enabling Israel to serve him, the building of the tabernacle, from 14 through chapter 40, the end of the book. So the panels are unequal in length, and yet the panels over and over again, they echo each other. And so if you sort of superimpose them, it's almost like you have, how many of you have seen those old projectors? You have a projector, you have like the picture here, but then you project it out and it gets bigger up on the screen. And so you have this first panel that is 13 chapters long, but then you have a 27 chapter panel that follows the same narrative structure, but a little bit bigger. Whereas the first panel follows the journey of Moses, the second panel follows the journey of Israel. And there are many, many parallels between the two panels. And so the second section of the first panel deals with Moses, the Lord appearing to Moses on the mountain of God and consecrating Moses as his messenger to Israel. So that's the second section of that first panel. But when that gets blown up on the second panel, we have the Lord appearing to Israel on the mountain of God and consecrating Israel as his messenger to the nations. So there is this idea that later stories echo earlier stories isn't just something that we see between the New Testament and the Old Testament. It's something that we see taking place in the Old Testament already. And it is something that we'd see taking place not only later stories echo earlier stories, but we also see earlier stories prefiguring later stories. There are all these sorts of narrative connections in the Old Testament itself. And that's really the key to the artistry of Hebrew narrative. And so we're in section 2. We've been in section 2 for a few weeks now. And that's found in chapters 19 through 24. So chapter 19 recounts how God came down to meet the children of Israel. And so it sets the stage for the covenant words found in chapter 20 and the covenant judgments found in 21 through 23. So chapter 20, verses 1 through 17 gives us the 10 words, the first of the two sections into which the old covenant is divided. The remainder of chapter 20, which is where we'll pick up in our time tonight, provides a transition to the next major section of the text, which are the three chapters of specific judgments found in 21 through 23. And then in chapter 24, the last chapter in this second section, we find the ratification of the covenant. And the covenant itself is 20 through 23. So we have preparations for the covenant. Then we have the covenant in 20 through 23. Then we have the ratification of the covenant in 24. And that wraps out the section. So tonight, Lord willing, we'll finish the rest of chapter 20. And then we'll get through the first 27 verses of chapter 21. So chapter 20 and verse 18. So God has just spoken the 10 words from Mount Sinai. And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. Pardon me. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. So when God spoke, the people were terrified. And this event is referred to in Hebrews, where the thunderings on Mount Sinai are contrasted with what took place on Mount Zion on the day of Pentecost. We have this contrast between Mount Zion and Mount Sinai, and that's picked up in the New Testament as well. Verse 20, and Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God has come to prove you that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. So Moses says, don't be afraid. God has come so that you will fear him. And in Hebrew, as well as in English, the word is the same for fear. The people did not need to be terrified of God, but they did need to have a genuine, reverent fear of God. One commentator's translation captures well the sense of the Hebrew phrase translated, that his fear may be before your faces, which sounds kind of strange to us. It's basically an idiom in Hebrew. And so if we were to try to put that into the way we would say that in English, he phrased it this way. And in order that the fear of him may be a vivid reality for you, so that the fear of God would be something that they would have perpetually in mind. And the fear of God is something that we need to have perpetually in mind. God is not our homeboy or our bestie. If we're to walk uprightly, we must not have a cringing terror of God where we're trembling before the mountain, but we ought to have a healthy reverence for God. Even today, the fear of the Lord remains the beginning of wisdom, as we're reminded so often throughout the Old Testament, especially in the wisdom literature. And the fear of the Lord is to be one of the chief characteristics of our community in the local church. We read in the book of Acts, then had the churches rest throughout all Judea, and Galilee and Samaria, and were edified, walking in the fear of the Lord, and in the comfort of the Holy Ghost were multiplied. So the churches walked in the fear of the Lord. We are to be people who fear the Lord. Rather than bringing us into bondage, a right fear of God is incredibly liberating, because when we fear the Lord as we ought to fear the Lord, then we don't need to be in terror before the face of man. When we have God before our faces, then we don't need to cringe before any human beings. Verse 21, and the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was. So based on the people's request, Moses is going to serve as the mediator for the remainder of the covenant. And so we have the giving of the words, the 10 words, and then the people say, it's too much. Moses, will you mediate for us? And Moses agrees to mediate for them, and God agrees to have Moses be the mediator. And so everything that follows in the old covenant is mediated by Moses. So then we find the response of the Lord and preparation for the ratification of the covenant. So in verses 18 through 21, we find the people's response. And then we have another section in 22 through 26. In some ways, these verses could be seen as the beginning of the judgments, because they do provide additional instructions beyond what's given in the 10 words. And yet in 21, when we get to chapter 21 and verse 1, there's a clear header in the text that says, now these are the judgments, and then all the judgments follow. And so because this instruction comes before the judgments, we should see it as somehow set apart. But when we pay close attention to the details of the structure, we can see that this section is actually in exactly the right place, because it serves as an introduction for the covenant ratification ceremony that's in chapter 24. And so what we're going to find is these verses give instructions for the building of an altar. Well, what are they going to need to do if they're going to ratify the covenant in chapter 24? They're going to need to build an altar. So it's sort of like this wraparound that you have the judgments in 21 through 23, and you have instructions, here's how to build an altar. Then when we get to 24, we find them building an altar. And so it's actually part of the literary structure of the text, that after that transition where the people ask Moses to mediate, there are these initial instructions that are given that are preparatory for what's going to follow. And then sandwiched between those two, which is a very common technique of sandwiching things in between parts that go together, is how we find the text. So verse 22, the Lord said unto Moses, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, ye have seen that I have talked with you from heaven. Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall you make unto you gods of gold. And so this is the second commandment. We talked about this a few weeks ago in detail. They are not to make any idols of any kind. Verse 24, an altar of earth shalt thou make unto me. So this instruction seems to be for the making of local altars, distinct from the more elaborate altars provided for in the tabernacle. So when we get to the tabernacle instructions, we're going to find instructions for the building of the bronze altar and the golden incense altar. But the tabernacle worship was not the only altars that were made. There were also altars that would be set up in other places. We find a reference to this idea of an altar of earth in 2 Kings 5. And Naaman said, shall there not, I pray thee, be given unto thy servant 2 mules burden of earth? For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. So when Naaman leaves from Elisha to go back to the land of Syria, he takes dirt with him because he wants dirt from the Holy Land to make an altar of earth, just like we find described here in Exodus chapter 20. And so in Exodus 24, we find Moses building an altar just like this. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord and rose up early in the morning and builded an altar under the hill and 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And we'll find he sacrificed burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of oxen unto the Lord. And these burnt offerings and peace offerings are what we find described as that which could be offered on this altar of earth. Thou shalt sacrifice thereon thy burnt offerings and thy peace offerings, thy sheep and thine oxen, in all places where I record my name, I will come unto thee, and I will bless thee. So these were the offerings that people, we already find record of the patriarchs, for instance, offering up whole burnt offerings and peace offerings. There were other offerings, like the atonement offerings, that were unique to the tabernacle worship. So we have offerings that were already made on altars like this one, that were already in place, and then we have further instructions for those in Leviticus, but we also have the addition of things like the Day of Atonement that were unique to the tabernacle system. And if we ever get to dealing with Leviticus, we'll get into all those details. Verse 25, if thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone, for if thou lift thy tool upon it, thou hast polluted it. There are some intriguing speculations about what this might mean, but I do not know what it means, and I don't know if anyone else does either. And we can't get into all the speculations about it for the sake of time. Verse 26, neither shalt thou go up by steps unto mine altar, that thy nakedness be not discovered thereon. Now, here's one thing we need to know. Ritualized nakedness, as well as ritualized sodomy, castration, and transgenderism, were a key part of many forms of pagan worship throughout the ancient world. In contrast to that, we have a clear and explicit concern in the biblical text, not only for clear distinctions between men and women, but also for the modesty of men and the modesty of women. And once again, this is talking about the worship that would take place at informal altars made away from a central sanctuary. And while the altar that Ezekiel describes does have steps, he also explicitly describes linen breeches that were to be worn by the priest. Now, breeches what we would call is briefs or boxer briefs or something like that. Those were not something that people would normally wear. But Ezekiel, even though they have an altar that has steps, is explicitly concerned that no exposure is going to take place while the offering of the Lord is being made. So the problem isn't steps, or that there's something evil about steps. The concern is for modesty. And as is repeatedly in the New Testament, how we dress continues to be important to God. Well, we must not confuse the particular rules that we come up with God's rules, as though God had authorized us to create his divine clothing manual, as though he somehow left that part out of the Bible. Christians are called to give attention to modesty in our apparel. We must never be so afraid of the accusation of legalism that we open ourselves up to the sexual displays of the pagans and dress just like they do. The fact that you're a follower of Jesus ought to affect the way that you dress and the clothes that you wear. I'm not going to give you a rule book, but I am going to tell you this. You need to tell me that when you're picking out what you're going to wear, you're thinking not only of what's acceptable in our culture, but what's acceptable to God. Don't get your standards of dress from our pagan culture. So now we come to the judgments themselves. But before we get into chapter 21, are there any questions about the rest of what we've covered in chapter 20? Teresa.
Ye shall not make with me gods of silver, neither shall ye make unto you gods of gold. So what is the point there with him talking about making unto God gods of silver and unto us gods of gold?
I would need to look at the Hebrew text, but I think that may just be a distinction. I don't think that's something we should see a major distinction going on there. It may just be an idiosyncrasy of translation. So I don't think we should see something major there. The main idea is going back to the commandment that it's we're not to make any form of idol. So we're not to make any image of God. There's a little bit with the grammar there that makes it a little tricky to know exactly what to do with it. But the main idea seems to be, so that is a good question to ask. I don't have the Hebrew text in front of me, but I remember reading about it, and I don't think there's a major distinction there. It's just how to deal with the grammar. That's a good question, though. Of all the weeks to have forgotten, I left my Hebrew Bible at home, so I could have looked that up and said something. Janine.
Are we going through the whole Exodus or just this first part? Because I have a question about something that happens later on. But
we're going to go through all the book of Exodus.
Because there's a provision for an earthly altar, right?
Yes.
That's what he said. So why did the people on the other side of the river get in trouble for building said earthly altar to offer offerings? And then they were going to go over there.
Oh, that's in Joshua.
Yeah. So why would... Did they just forget that they're allowed to do that, or is that...
This is one of the most complicated... No, I know. So, this is a difficult question, because you have Elijah offering... So the challenge is you have these instructions for a central offering, a central altar in Deuteronomy 12. So it seems like we're given these initial things that it was okay in the past and even at this point, but then later on, that'd be the most straightforward way of reading, say, Deuteronomy 12. Later on, there is a single central altar that everyone's supposed to go to. Except you have, say, something like Elijah's altar on Mount Carmel. So you actually have even God's appointed prophets, you know, offering sacrifices at other places. And so the sort of two ways of looking at that, one, you could say that, you know, even God's anointed people departed from his instructions. Or you could say that the centralization commands refer explicitly to the sort of tabernacle worship and not to these other sorts of altars. It is a messy enough thing that I don't have a strong opinion either way. And it gets really confused because a lot of more skeptical scholars will use this as a basis for all kinds of reconstructions. And so of things that would go contrary, I think, to the biblical text. And so sorting through all of that is one of those puzzles that I hope to, you know, as we get through into if we ever teach on Deuteronomy, those instructions, then I would take the time to really dive into it. But it is, I don't think it's unresolvable, but I haven't sorted it completely clearly in my own mind. So I'm aware of that as an issue, but I'm not completely clear how to resolve it. I thought about that as I was working through this, but...
I mean, because they left them in the end. They didn't go to war.
Right.
They let it,
yep.
But wouldn't that be the provision of they should have been able to do it anyways because they couldn't necessarily just travel across the river?
Yeah. The centralization of worship and how that relates to, say, what takes place in Josiah's day, what takes place in Elijah's day, David's day, like, that is... That is one of the key sort of questions of how to, one of the key questions to which there isn't an immediately clear answer. So I wish I had a better answer, but I don't. It's a good question, though. I was hoping no one would ask that, but. No, it's a good question. Just shows you what you should do with the questions you're hoping nobody answers. You should try to figure it out. But I suspect that would take me a couple weeks of work to dig into all of that, and I just did not have that for this lesson. But now I know, and I need to think about it more. All right, anyone else before we move on? Oh, you're not in trouble. I'm the one that should have had an answer. So as we get into the judgments are found in 21 through 23. And in 21:1 through 22:20, we have legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of situations. So these are the judgments proper in 21 through 22:20. Then in 22:21 through 23:9, we have moral imperatives that would apply to every situation. So most of 21 and through 22:20 are, if this happens, then here's how you should respond. If this happens, then here is how you should respond. But then in 22:21, we have another section that are more moral imperatives. And a lot of them are things that would not be enforceable in any court of law. They're more simply the sort of people that you should be. It's not a hard and fast distinction, but there's a clear transition that takes place there. And then in 23:10 through 19, we have information about the Sabbath and other festivals. And then in 23:20 through 33, we have some information about the occupation of the land of Canaan. And so the first section, the judgments themselves, is from 21:1 through 22:20. And really a way of describing what's taking place here is that they provide legal wisdom exemplified in a variety of situations. So the point of the collection of judgments in 21:1 through 22:20 isn't to provide a comprehensive overview of all possible situations, but to provide wisdom by explaining what to do in cases that illustrate the various principles by which judgment was to be made. So a quote that is helpful on this: the technique in this section is to compress multiple legal issues into a small number of complex and paradigmatic cases. So we're called upon to imagine a wide variety of situations, to see them in all their complexity, and then to learn from those particular situations what principles they were to apply in other situations. So it's not like statute law where we lay out all the penalties, all the things you're not supposed to do. It doesn't work like that. It's rather representative examples that teach you how you're supposed to think about justice. What does justice look like? By giving particular examples. Now, sometimes they're given really clear instructions, like, don't let a witch live. That's a clear instruction. But more often, it's giving these sorts of situations where multiple principles apply, and then the intention was they would take those principles, they would take that aspect of wisdom, and then they would figure out what aspects of that wisdom applied to a particular situation. Some of the situations are genuinely ambiguous because it was a long time ago. And we don't know exactly the situation. So it's calling us to envision a situation, and it was giving them plenty of information to envision exactly what was going on and to learn from it. But sometimes it's very clear to us what was going on. At other times, we could say, well, it's either talking about this or this, and we can learn what we can from it, but it's not always completely clear. And so we'll see that. And some of them would potentially be resolvable, but not in the time that I have to prepare a Sunday night lesson, and not in the time that we have to discuss the material. So there are some limitations, but there also are some exciting things in this section of Scripture. Though we're no longer under these judgments as a covenant, to the extent that we are able to understand the principles that they teach, they remain a binding guide to what justice ought to look like in our lives and in our world. So we are called to learn from these what justice looks like, not only in our private lives, but insofar as we have an influence on society, we can learn principles of justice for society from these as well. And throughout all the details, these judgments have two central themes. So there's two overriding themes. There is an even-handedness to justice. That's a central theme. So there are no carve-outs for the rich, there's no preferential treatment for the poor. There's an even-handedness to justice, and there's a concern, we'll see this multiple times, there's a concern to prevent the abuse of the system, right? This is what happens when you create really rigid rules. People find a way to use them for their own advantage. And that is something we don't find. It's not so much rigid rules as in principles of wisdom to keep people from abusing the system and actually enacting injustice in some way by using the law to create injustice. And there's also an attempt to balance the penalties of crimes between compensation to the wronged and then deterrence for the offender. So the first principle is the even-handed justice. And the second is the sanctity of life, and that all human life is valued, not just the lives of the rich or the powerful or the free. And crimes against life are treated as fundamentally different from crimes against property. And especially this idea of sanctity of life is something that sets apart the legal wisdom that we find in Exodus from the legal wisdom that we find in other law codes from the ancient Near East. And so this is an area in which the biblical wisdom we find in the text of Scripture strikingly differs from what we find in, say, the Code of Hammurabi or other law codes that we might have uncovered in the ancient Near East. And this is a way in which Christians, as our society becomes pagan once again, we're going to need to go back to these foundational principles of justice to learn what true justice looks like. So the first section of the judgments is in verses 1 to 11, and we find a series of judgments on Hebrew slaves. Now, I'm just really excited about this, so if you're not, just bear with me and smile anyways. No other ancient law code deals with slaves first. So Hammurabi's code, for instance, which is the most famous law code known from the ancient Near East, deals with slaves last. And also, these instructions, it's not just the fact that slaves are placed first, but that the actual instructions about slaves are radically countercultural in the ancient Near East. There is no ancient law code that is concerned with how masters treat their own slaves. There's lots of laws about how, you know, what will happen if you mistreat somebody else's slaves because they're their property and you're harming that person. But the biblical law code is the only one that's concerned with how masters treat their slaves. So, the biblical law was radically countercultural in its day. It's not accurate to say that the Bible supports slavery and just to leave it at that. But there's even more here. When we actually get into the nitty-gritty details of the economic conditions of slaves in ancient Israel, if they had followed God's laws, not as they didn't follow God's laws, right? They rebelled against those laws. But if we're to look at the way they were to be treated, had these laws been applied, even in the horrific racial slavery system of the American South, with all of the injustices that occurred, God's laws would have been better for the slaves than what happened after the Civil War, where they were all forcibly freed and then mistreated horribly. Had God's laws actually been implemented, it would have resulted in more justice than with the sense of moral superiority that we have today very often in our society. We are not as enlightened. Our society is not as enlightened as it thinks it is. In point of fact, I would go so far to say that slavery, if one were actually to follow the biblical rules of righteousness as expressed in the Old Covenant, would not only have been more just than what happened to the slaves after the Civil War, it would also be more just than most of the economic arrangements we have with wage labor in America right now in the technological society. To return to the main point, though, the initial focus on laws regarding slaves fits in with a law code directed to newly freed slaves. Having been rescued from harsh oppression, they are not themselves to become oppressors. And there are also, this is the part that I'm most excited about, we'll get to once we get to the details, there are a number of allusions in these laws to the specific narrative context in which these laws are found. They're not just a collection of rules, they are themselves part of the story of the Exodus. One point to be very clear on, in the Old Covenant Code, slavery was not racially based as it was in the American South and has been in other places. One would become a slave primarily because of debt or a crime, or just making some bad decisions or encountering some misfortune in life. Kidnapping and selling into slavery, as we'll see, which is what was taking place in the American South primarily, where people were kidnapped out of Africa, taken across the sea, and sold into slavery, was a capital crime in the Old Testament law. Non-Hebrew slaves would generally have come from captives in war, but even non-Hebrew slaves, as we'll see, had a number of protections. So as we come to the judgments on slaves, we're presented with two different scenarios. So we have in verses 1 through 6, we have a male ebed is the word used, and then in verses 7 through 11, we have a female ama, and there's some things there we'll have to get to when we get to there, but first let's look at verses 1 through 6. Now these are the judgments thou shalt set before them. If thou buy an Hebrew servant or slave, 6 years he shall serve. So 6 years is the maximum period of service. So presumably lesser debts. If you didn't run up 6 years worth of debt, you could be enslaved for 1 year's worth of debt. But 6 years was the maximum time that a fellow Hebrew could be in slavery. And so the idea is that one would sell oneself into slavery as the result of a debt. So you borrow more money than you could repay, and so now you have to sell yourself into slavery. Or perhaps a crime. You stole one sheep and you ate the sheep, but you needed to pay 4 sheep back. But you didn't have any sheep. And so you then would end up in slavery for a period of time. If you've been stealing and eating sheep on an industrial scale, then you might end up in slavery for a bit of time. And in the seventh, he shall go out free for nothing. So you will provide him what he needs, but it's not just, so he'll still go out free, and he doesn't have to pay you anything to go out free, so there's no ransom money for this slave. In the seventh year, he goes out free for nothing, but he doesn't go out empty. Deuteronomy 15:13. And when thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock, out of thy floor, out of thy winepress, of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. Once again, God's idea of slavery, had the Israelites actually followed it, had more care and concern than our technological society's vision of freedom. When the slave was done with his term, he was set up with a household of his own. He was set up to be productive on his own account. How many employers do that when you're done working for them? Set you up in competition to them. Government doesn't set you up to compete with the government. When you're done with the military, the government doesn't give you tanks and planes. That's the idea that's going on. That's the idea that's going on here. So you can get a pension, but this is more than a pension. This is actually something by which you could go out and provide for yourself rather than just giving money. Verse 3, if he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master have given him a wife, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Now, at first glance, this seems to be in clean contrast to everything I've been saying. It seems calloused and perhaps even cruel. But it's only because we haven't thought thoroughly about the situation that's actually implied here. While we can't be certain of all the details, the following quote makes very good sense of the concern of the text. So possibly this ruling was intended to prevent a breach of faith on the part of the slave. In all likelihood, the slave's marriage was funded by his master, probably on the understanding that in return the slave would continue to serve beyond the required period of 6 years. Given the cost of marriage, a substantial betrothal present had to be paid to the bride's father. No debt slave could enter into such an arrangement unless supported by his master. So in order to secure Rachel as his wife, Jacob pledged himself to serve Laban for 7 years. In the light of this, the ruling prohibited the going out of the wife and children. The ruling prohibiting the going out of the wife and children protects a generous master who provides a partner for his slave. A slave who wished to ensure his own freedom and that of his wife and family could always postpone marriage until after his release in the seventh year. So the idea here is that the master, the slave, has said, oh, I'm going to serve you permanently. We find the arrangements for that here in a few verses. And so the master, on the basis of that promise, has paid for a wife, which could cost as much as the whole term of the slave service for the slave because he's generously providing. And this is a provision to protect the master from being taken advantage of by a deceitful slave who's going back on his word. Verse 5. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free. If the slave was treated as a member of the household, and he hadn't done well on his own, remember, you're being in slavery because you're in debt, because you had a bad run of things, and maybe you just didn't do so great on your own, and you had it really well in your master's household, then you might have a reason to say, you know what? I have it way better this way than I do on my own. We have echoes of this in the parable of the prodigal son. And then he might very well have been better off as a slave for a good master. Then his master shall bring him unto the judges. So the Hebrew word here, we talked about this earlier, is Elohim. It's literally God or gods. But there are some places where this word Elohim can refer to human magistrates. So Psalm 82, we talked about this last week. Someone, Elijah brought it up, as Elijah Haman brought it up as a question of what's going on in Psalm 82. And so it seems likely that in Psalm 82, Elohim refers to human judges. And that's how the King James takes it here. It's also possible that it has the idea of coming before the sanctuary, possibly before the priest at the tabernacle. So the idea of going before God has that idea. So it could be either or. But in any case, the point is that this requires something public. So the master can't just say, hey, slave, you're not my slave, but whatever. The master can't just say, hey, this slave wants to work for me for the rest of his life without having a public, having other judges who could say, hey, do you actually want to do that? Or is he like have a gun to your back or something, right? So this had to be a public agreement. So that's one element. So it can't be a merely private ceremony in which someone is coerced into becoming a permanent household member. But there's also a domestic element to this, because the slave is becoming a member of his household. So he shall also bring him to the door, or unto the doorpost, and his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Now, if we're paying attention, there's a strong connection between this opening judgment and the narrative context. What was Israel supposed to do? What was Israel there at Mount Sinai to do? Serve the Lord? The word for love has only been used one time in Exodus. What's the context? Israel is to love the Lord and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. So the relationship between Israel and God was to be one of love and one of service. Was that service supposed to continue for just a few years, or was it supposed to be for a lifetime, forever? They were supposed to serve God, not because they had to serve God, but because they loved God. The Israelites should willingly serve the Lord forever out of love. And so if you go through this initial command on the male Ebed, so this first part, so initial instruction on slavery is sort of a two panel. You have the case of the Hebrew Ebed, and then you have the case of the female Amma. And in this first panel, you have this narrative trajectory of a slave who comes into the master's household, but at the end of it, he says, I love my master, I want to serve my master, he's been good to me, I love him, I'm going to stay with him and serve him forever. That's the narrative, that's the story, that's the trajectory of this, and that parallels Israel's relationship with God. But remember I told you that the book of Exodus is a tale of two building projects. You have Pharaoh's building project, you have God's building project. Well, in this initial instruction about slavery, we have a tale of two masters. And the narrative trajectory of the one reflects what was supposed to happen between Israel and the Lord. And the narrative trajectory of the second half relates to the relationship between Israel and who do you think might that might be? Who is the other master in Exodus? Pharaoh. So we're going to see. The first one has echoes of the relationship between Israel and the Lord. The second one has echoes of the relationship between Israel and Pharaoh. But before we get onto that, there's some clear principles of righteousness for us to learn before we continue on with the narrative. First, God has a particular care for seeing justice done to the least valued and most despised members of society, even when their status is the result of their own foolishness, as would have been the case for the vast majority of Hebrew slaves. When they entered into the land of Canaan, they all got an inheritance. So if one person is in so much debt that he has to sell himself into slavery, most likely it is his own fault. And yet God is very concerned with how that faulty person is treated. The survival of the fittest is not to characterize the economic activity of God's people. There were consequences for folly, right? He wasn't the one employing other slaves. He was the one having to work for somebody else. Right, so there were consequences for folly, but there was also concern for the weak and the foolish and the vulnerable. Second, as a perhaps more speculative principle, we should seriously consider the justice of allowing people to contract more collateral free debt than they can pay off in 7 years. And this ought to call our current practice of student loans into radical question. The average student borrower takes 20 years to pay off their student loan debt. Some professional graduates take over 45 years to repay student loans. And the principle that we have in Exodus is no matter how much debt you accumulated, you could work it off in 6 years and go out free and provided for in the seventh. So do you think that may have posed somewhat of a cap about how much debt you could run up in society? Because once you hit that 6 year mark, ain't nobody going to lend you any more money. You're going to have to deal with the debt that you have rather than snowballing it endlessly. And then, of course, that has increased the cost of education astronomically. So it's almost impossible to get a education that gives you some of those better jobs without going into debt, which makes it ever more expensive, which creates all sorts of injustices. And the point I'm making is not, as some in our society would, that these debts should necessarily be forgiven at others' expense, but that such loans should never have been made to begin with. Fourth, those who are disadvantaged should not attempt to take advantage of the generosity of others. We have that whole provision that was, it seems to be, it's a little bit, we're not completely sure what it's talking about, but the most plausible way of reading it is that it's designed to protect the master from being taken advantage of by a scheming slave who's trying to get a wife at his master's expense and then not fulfill his end of the bargain, right? So justice doesn't just look like taking advantage of the poor and the vulnerable. It looks like keeping the poor and the vulnerable from taking advantage of those who would seek to be generous to them. So this brings us then to a second situation. Now, at first glance, you might think this is simply referring to the female version of the male Hebrew slave discussed above. You might think, well, the first scenario talks about a male slave and the second scenario talks about a female slave. But actually, it's a bit more complicated than that, as a glance at the parallel passage in Deuteronomy make clear. These verses raise a number of puzzles, most of which we'll not be able to completely resolve. But despite the questions that remain, the righteousness towards which this points is clear, and the narrative echoes in the pattern that we find is also clear. Verse 7. If a man sell his daughter to be a maidservant, the Hebrew word for maidservant is amah. And what makes this tricky is that the word amah can be used both for a female servant and also for a wife under certain conditions. And there's a lot that we don't know about the social structure of ancient Israel, about what terms were used for what people in different statuses. There's just a lot of details we can't be completely sure about. So as we dive into the thicket here, there are two possible ways of making sense of this scenario. The first is that the amah in question enters into a consummated relationship with her master as a wife. So then, in this scenario, if this is the way we're seeing it, we're talking about what happens when that master becomes dissatisfied with the amah and wants to supplement or replace her with another woman. So in the first scenario, this woman enters into an actual relationship that is consummated with the master, and he gets bored with her or wants to replace her with someone else. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that the amah in question has been given only the promise of marriage. So this is talking about an engagement or even the promise of an engagement, either to the master or his sons. And that engagement is not consummated. So there's not an actual marriage or a physical relationship. But the master attempts to renege on the promise of marriage when circumstances change and he wants someone else other than that girl. While good arguments can be made for both, and there are many details we don't know, I do think that this second scenario makes somewhat better sense of the text. One commentator explains it this way. The amah rulings in 21:7-11 address the situation of a girl who is sold on the understanding that she will become a wife in due course. So this ruling applies only to female slaves who are acquired on the understanding that they will be married. The sale of the girl is probably prompted by a financial crisis within the family, and the money that is received comes in lieu of the betrothal present, which the father might have expected to receive at the time of his daughter's marriage. The father would have been expected to provide his daughter with a dowry, but this might not have been possible in a time of poverty. And so the rulings in 7-11 seek to safeguard the position of the girl, who has lost the immediate protection of her family and the normal financial security that surrounded a marriage. So in this second understanding, what's going on is usually when a girl would get married, you'd have that substantial betrothal present that would go to the family. So when Jacob marries Laban's daughter, Jacob has to provide a lot of money, or in his case, a lot of work to Laban. But in order to receive that, you'd have to wait until your daughters were of a marriageable age. So in this scenario, someone who is not yet of a marriageable age, not yet ready to enter into a marriage relationship, could get the betrothal present ahead of time to perhaps keep the whole family from being sold into debt slavery. And so the girl is given the promise of marriage, but until that marriage actually takes place, she's working as a slave or a servant in another household. And so because of that, she's not yet entered into marriage, but she's already removed from the protection of her family. She's in a vulnerable position. And so this is designed to protect her. She shall not go out as the men servants do. As an actual or prospective marriage, this is intended to be a permanent arrangement. If she please not her master, who hath betrothed her to himself, and there's some textual things there we won't get into as well, then shall he let her be redeemed. To sell her unto a strange nation he shall have no power, seeing he hath dealt deceitfully with her. So regardless of or not, whether or not the situation envisioned is one where he marries her or simply has promised to marry her and then doesn't want to follow through, in no case can he sell this girl off as if she was a regular slave girl, as if no promises had been made to her. She is instead to be redeemed by her family so she can be married to someone else. And verse 9, if he have betrothed her unto his son, he shall deal with her after the manner, literally the judgment of daughters. And this is a clue that these judgments, it's the same word, these are the judgments you shall set before them. These judgments are not intended to be comprehensive, dealing with every scenario, but rather as a supplement, helping them to correct maybe some of the things that they already would have had. Verse 10, if he take him another wife, her food, her raiment, and her duty of marriage. Now, this is the tricky one, and the way that you translate this really depends on how you envision the situation. So, if he take him another wife, that could refer to taking a second wife if he's already married to this girl. Or it could refer to simply taking a different wife. So, he said he was going to marry her, but he doesn't want to marry her, so he takes a different wife instead of her. That's possible. Either of those would fit the text. Her duty of marriage. This is the only time in the Hebrew Bible that this word occurs, and no one is completely certain what it refers to. So how you translate the text depends almost entirely on the situation you envision behind the text. So if an actual marriage is being described, situation one, then marital relations or duty of marriage would be a sensible translation. She is not to be kept from having children simply because he has another wife. If a reneged engagement is being described, situation two, which I would take as more probable, then plausible translations include a reference to shelter or oil, the sort of things that would be provided not to a regular slave girl, but to one engaged to be married to the master. So the idea is that her provision is not to be diminished because the engagement wasn't followed through on. And I think that's more plausible, but there's some debate as to which of those situations is in view. Verse 11. And if he do not these three unto her, doesn't provide these three things to her, then shall she go out free without money. So he can either continue to provide for her in a manner appropriate to their original agreement, or he can free her to enter into another marriage with no compensation to himself. But he cannot renege on the agreement and have her pay the penalty for it. That's what he can't do. So once again, there's a powerful connection to the story of the Exodus, and we can see that connection regardless of all the details. There's lots of details. Some of your heads are probably spinning. Mine is too. In some of the background details of this, we can't be exactly sure what's going on, but the overall point is still very clear. And here's the point. On either understanding, the problem is of a master, a powerful man, who reneges on his promises when circumstances change. Is this ringing any bells yet? Because this is exactly what Pharaoh did when the Israelites were no longer convenient. When the Egyptians needed the Hebrews, they made them all sorts of promises. And when they didn't need them anymore, they broke all of those promises. They reneged on their promises. Their word was not their bond. And God's response was to redeem Israel out from under Pharaoh's hand, to protect Israel from an abusive master. And what one nation in the earth is like thy people, even like Israel, whom God went to redeem for a people to himself, and to make him a name, and to do for you great things and terrible for thy land before thy people, which thou redeemest to thee from Egypt, from the nations and their gods. This is why the narrative thrust of the first example leads to a relationship of perpetual love, and the narrative thrust of the second leads to escape and freedom. At the very same time as the Israelites were being given practical instructions on how to treat slaves, they were being presented with a powerful tale of two masters, a striking contrast between the relationship of Israel and God that was to lead to perpetual love because they were well cared for, and the relationship between Israel and Pharaoh, that based on Pharaoh's abuse of the relationship, based on the fact that they had reneged on their agreement, could only result in Israel's freedom. There's also some practical things that we can learn from this about what God's wisdom and righteousness looks like. Regardless of the exact details of the situation, the point is the temptation to allow changed circumstances to change one's commitments. We are tempted to do that, and we must not do that. This is something the righteousness towards which we are called absolutely prohibits. Though we can change our mind, we cannot do so at someone else's expense. In whose eyes, the Psalms say, a vile person is contemned, but he honoreth them that fear the Lord. He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. This is central to the righteousness to which God's children are called. When we change our minds, we must not do so at the expense of the commitments that we've already made. And if anybody's going to pay the penalty for our change of mind, it needs to be us and not the people who are depending on us to be trustworthy men and women of our word. Before we move on with the text, any questions on this first section of the judgments? Once. Yes.
So, in any circumstance, the girl is not allowed to be just a slave. She's supposed to be married.
Right.
That's how she's sold or bought.
She's not allowed to be taken advantage of.
Correct. So when there's a person that's already in slavery because he had to sell himself for whatever debt or whatever, and he asks the master for this wife, she's already free? And now she's entering into slavery with her husband?
I think in order to know how to sort of connect those two things, it has to be really clear what the details are of the second. So, like, they're just some, you know, so I think the overall point that, like, the slave is to be provided for, we can see that pretty clearly, that the girl is not to be taken advantage of, there's not to be a renegment on the agreement, I think that's clear.
Right.
But exactly what all the potential statuses were for a woman in ancient Israel is...
If the master's paying for the wife for his slave, then she's entering into that as well.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not completely sure what. So I'm
just trying to figure out, like, if she's already free and then he's paying for her, so she's going into debt for her family or whatever, right?
Right.
So she's already becoming a slave, and then he just lets them get married, and then they stay together, or the guy leaves on his own. But
yeah.
She doesn't get a 7-year freedom.
Right. Right, because, you know, so if you are, you know, so a woman in ancient Israel is supposed, you know, there's no ability for her to independently provide for herself. So the only situation in which she is provided for is as a member of a household.
Okay.
So simply, you know, putting her out on her own without the ability for her to get married is not doing good to her. So the idea is, like, you know, treating her like used goods is not giving her freedom. So when the man can go out, he can go out, he's set up for life, he can, you know, start his own farm or whatever, right? But the girl isn't going to be able to do that.
She has to stay with the master.
Right. So that's for her protection. So we don't always think of that because we think of, you know, women can go out and get jobs as well as men, but that just isn't the case in ancient Israel.
Was there ever a provision for her to be able to eventually go out with her husband and take their children?
Well, okay, I think I see what you're saying. I think these are two different scenarios. So the girl, the Amma, isn't talking about the wife that was provided for the slave. They're just two completely different scenarios.
Okay.
Two completely different scenarios.
I'm really confused.
No, okay, that makes sense of the question now. Yeah, they're two completely different scenarios. And exactly how they would interface, I'd have to be much more certain about the understanding of the one and the other to know. I just don't think we know enough about the social structure of ancient Israel to know the status of, say, the slave. Yeah. So I think we should see them as two separate situations, because that's sort of the structure we see in the rest of these judgments, that we have here's a scenario, and here's a scenario, and here's a scenario, rather than they don't necessarily build on one another. Now, in real life, they would, but in order to know what that would look like, we would just have to know a whole lot more about the real life than we actually do. You're asking good questions. I wish my answers were as good as the questions. Abby.
Okay, so I don't have the Bible in front of me, so I can't like flip through scripture and just like know what I'm talking about. So just disclaimer on my question. But first of all, just I appreciate what you said about just, you know, if your circumstance changed, don't change your commitment, or however you said that. That was just appreciated. But I was just going to ask, did Laban, would you say that Laban took advantage
yes.
of Jacob?
Yes.
Okay. And by kind of tricking him
yes.
in a way. And then...
Change my wages 10 times.
Yes. Okay, again, like I just don't have the Bible in front of me. I feel like I could probably answer these questions if I read it, but... hold on, I wrote it down. And then I was just going to ask, do you think it was sinful of Jacob to actually go back into slavery for Rachel when he already received a wife, when he already received Leah? Because at that point he had already committed to her, and I just kind of always wondered, like, Jacob going back into slavery for another wife out of the heart that he wanted Rachel instead of Leah. I thought actually that it made my mind ponder the fact that, like, he wasn't satisfied with the wife he was given, and he still was pursuing this other wife. But what would your perspective be on that?
I think there's so much broken in the story right. of Laban and Jacob that identifying that one particular thing as sinful, you know, so clearly polygamy is a departure from God's creational design.
Right.
But to what extent that was going to be clear to Jacob, mm-hmm. you know, so I think... you know, to what extent that was the problem in Jacob's life, I don't know.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we're told enough in the text to be certain. Mm-hmm. So clearly we could say that was not God's creational intent. That's not God's revealed will. You know, but exactly like I don't know if that isn't something the text draws attention to is the major problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the major problem is that he doesn't have love for Rachel, for Leah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this tension. And yet, you know, one of the really exciting things to me in Genesis is you have the narrative, I think it's in 29 through 30, of how Rachel and Leah and their handmaid are fighting like cats and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is just awful. It's horrible. But then when you get to the genealogy in 46, you have this glorious numerical structure of perfection. And it's a way of saying that in the midst of all of the sin and the messiness and the catfighting of Jacob's family, God was at work to create the family he had intended all along.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't creating their sin, but their sin was not a hindrance to God's fulfillment of the promise.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we shouldn't look at the story of Jacob and say, oh, Jacob did that, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go for a second woman. That's definitely not the message we're supposed to take away from the story of Jacob. But I think the message we're supposed to take away, and I think this is what the text is pointing us towards, is that our messes and mistakes mm-hmm. can't thwart God's promises.
Mm-hmm.
They have consequences, right? Jacob's family was a real mess. So there were consequences. And yet the mess of Jacob's family couldn't thwart God's promises.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that should be the overall takeaway that we should have from that.
Yeah. I just think, like, sometimes when you read that, you look at what Jacob did as kind of romantic, and you're like, oh, wow, you know, he pursued
yeah,
her
no, I know.
14 years, and it's this romantic idea. But I just look at that, and I go, there's really nothing, like, I don't think we should look at that like, oh, how romantic and great of Jacob.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. No, I think that's a good point. But I think sometimes, like, some of the questions we might have just aren't the questions the text is answering.
Exactly.
And so that, yeah, that would...
Just knowing God can redeem... All
yes,
things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Anything else, Brother Ron?
The rules are quite a bit different for non-Hebrew slaves, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so this is dealing with for Hebrew slaves, but we'll find, which we will not find tonight because we're not going to get there at this point. But when we get later on to the judgments about a brutal master, those protections are not only for Hebrew slaves, but also for non-Hebrew slaves. So there are protections for Hebrew slaves in particular, and it's interesting that it separates these judgments about Hebrew slaves and non-Hebrew slaves. Because I think this is intentionally, I don't think it's happenstance that we have it opening with this narrative echo that parallels Israel's whole experience and the whole story. This is an intentional part of the structure of the story. So we have these other provisions for all slaves later on. But this is a tale of two sorts of masters with two narrative trajectories. And it opens this covenant. And it's really quite astonishing. But yes, it is a different scenario, but there are also protections for them. Brother Chad.
So I know Jeanine was kind of confused there, but she brings up a good question. Was there provision for if a slave leaves, is there a way for him to get his children and his wife out of slavery? Or is the only option to go out by yourself or to stay a slave to have your family?
I think a lot would depend on what the actual status of the wife was. So, like, that, I don't know if we can answer that question. Like, there's some of this, like, there are whole long books that are written just on the covenant code, but I didn't read them last week. So I did read commentaries, but, you know, there are thousands of pages that are written on these things. But in doing a survey of Exodus, it's one of the reasons going slowly through Matthew is I do try to tackle all these questions. But I don't want to go quite as slowly through Matthew as this. And there also are just a lot more things about the social fabric of, like, the text tells us some things, but then it's like, you dig up these tablets in one place and they provide some background, but you dig up these tablets in another place and they provide a different background, which, if either of them, is relevant for explaining the text. And that really, you know, it's like sometimes people are very, very confident. It's because they're only looking at a narrow slice of the evidence and taking that. So it's often like when you look at all the evidence, you see, like, we can imagine multiple scenarios in which the text would make sense, but knowing for certain which of those scenarios is hard. But I think what I was hoping to show is that even though there's fuzziness on those details, the actual point is to teach us righteousness, and we can pretty clearly discern the thrust of that righteousness and apply it in our lives, even without answering all our questions. Not that it wouldn't be profitable to try to do that. It just would be enormously, I would have to spend a long time, and even so, there'd be no guarantee that, you know, you'd get there. Ruth, you had a question.
It was a question on the same topic. I was kind of wondering if we were getting a little lost in the weeds there. And since this story is obviously a theoretical and not given as a story that necessarily actually happened, is there any possibility that it's simply, like you said, they were stories, basically, rich guy, don't take advantage of your slave. Slave, don't take advantage of a master. Is there any possibility that it was simply that a theoretical scenario that he was like?
Yeah, all of these are theoretical scenarios, you know, but they're theoretical scenarios that are designed to illustrate these multiple legal principles. But it's almost like it's speaking into a situation, you know. So if we had some instructions on what to do with email and we had two or three things you shouldn't do with email, there might still be some questions about how email functions that we couldn't answer. Right. If we knew nothing about email and we just had some instructions about not spamming your friends and how soon you should respond, there still would be some questions about, like, you know, what's an email server? So, you know what I'm saying? There'd be a lot of questions we wouldn't be able to reach. If we thought of any sort of social institution and we just had this amount of information about it, there would be aspects of it that we wouldn't be able to reconstruct. And so I think that's probably what's, you know, that's certainly not probably what's going on here, that there are some things we could discern There are some things we can say, could be this or this, but there's always going to be that extra that is just like, this happened a long time ago and very far away. And it's profitable to think through it, but we can get the main point without getting all the background. But sometimes it can be very profitable when we can figure it out. All right, I guess we're out of time. So we are not getting any further tonight, but this was exciting for me and hopefully for at least some of you as well.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for opening up a Bible and reading it for yourself.